This week's conversation with Yvette Stanton is sponsored by Sassy Jack's Stitchery. Two big things are happening at Sassy Jack's. In addition to the expected opening of the Sassy Jack's store in August, be sure to sign up for the September Soiree online retreat, September 15 to 18. Each year the Soiree has been a big hit, and this year promises to be the best yet. You can now also sign up for a series of October workshops with Jackie Duplessis. The October 3 and 4 workshop is called Hold Dear, a beautifully decorated tiger maple project box with two storage areas and a pincushion in the lid. That's followed by Love That Red, a drawn thread sewing roll-up sampler on October 5 and 6. October 7 will be a bit of a mystery that will involve a fall flame stitch and a beautiful bespoke wooden box. Then, on October 8, you can stitch the Morning Glory work basket. Sign up for all of these workshops is by email only. Much more information is available through the Sassy Jack's website at sassyjackstitchery.com, the Jack's Journal newsletter, or the Sassy Jack's Facebook page. It's going to be a busy fall at Sassy Jack's Stitchery. Don't miss out. And now, our conversation with Yvette Stanton. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. And our artist this week, back for the third time, Yvette Stanton of Vetti Creations. Yvette, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hey, good to have you back. Boy, I didn't realize how long it had been. March of 2021. So,
Wow, that is a while. Yeah.
Yeah, we got to do this more often. Yep.
Okay.
All right, we got some questions. We have a book to talk about. But then before we start recording, I was asking you if you'd ever used a slate frame, and you're not. You're a small hoop person on a stand or a holder. But you were talking about how with this new book, which is dealing with filling stitches for hardanger, that you find you don't want a lot of tension in the ground?
No, because often the stitches that I'm putting in across the empty holes are diagonal. And if I tighten my fabric too much, like if I make it really tight, when I let that go out of the hoop back to resting, those diagonals can go wiggly. And I don't want that. I want them to be nice and straight across my hole. So I find that I have to be really careful with putting it in the hoop to make sure the tension is about what it would be at rest.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So is this a change from what you would normally do?
I probably have never done enough diagonal stitches across a hole before to really notice the difference that makes.
Oh.
But because I've been focusing on filling stitches, I've been doing a lot of that lately.
That's interesting. So, all right, but so let's back up then. So ground cloth tension in hardanger, would you normally want it really tight, or is it better if it's got a little looseness to it?
Generally, I do all of my hardanger stitching in hand, so therefore it has no tightness whatsoever. I find that that helps me get a rhythm up much better. My hand has muscle memory, and so therefore I insert the needle in the right way much more easily if I'm doing it in hand. A lot of people, though, they find it easier to do it in a hoop, so that's fine. You can do that too. But I've just found that working all of these filling stitches, particularly when those diagonal stitches, I want to put it in a hoop just to make sure nothing gets stretched or tightened.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I'm really enjoying the slate frame and, you know, the extreme tightness. But I'm doing some crewel embroidery, so.
Yes. So different things for different purposes.
Well, I just, it's an interesting area to explore because it, you know, it reflects in your finished piece. So, yeah. Learn something there.
Right. And I know mine is the casket. And so I was warned not to stretch it too much because if it's stretched too much, people have taken it off of their slate frames and it no longer fits on their casket and they've had to cut their stitching out.
Oh, yeah, you don't want that to happen.
No. No. So there's some sort of balance there for the right amount of tension.
Yeah.
For whatever you're working on.
See, it's these little things that fascinate me because so many of them are difference makers. And
sometimes it's a matter of figuring that out yourself. You try something and it doesn't produce the result you want. So then you try it a different way and you get the result you want.
Yeah. Because, Beth, I mean, on a casket, the last thing you want to do is have that panel not fit when you go to apply it to the wood or box or whatever it is.
Right. And you want to know that fairly early on in the process, too, so that you don't waste a whole lot of time and materials.
That's right. That's right. Because this is a lot of fiddly stuff that's going on this casket. So it's, you know, you're using a lot of different types of materials. So, I was glad to learn that I needed to be careful about that when I stretched it on my on my slate frame.
Because Mary Corbett was talking today, the day we were recording. There, I didn't explore it thoroughly, but she was talking about a project she's working on and shrinkage. Because I know if you wash your linen, for instance, in hot water, you can shrink it and cause a problem the other way, too.
Yep, that's right.
Have to think about these things. Good. Yep. All right. Tell us about this book.
So in October
and
last
hurry up
year,
with it, will you?
Hasn't actually been that long. I started working on it in October last year because someone suggested in a Hardanger Facebook group that I'm in that this was a book that they'd been wanting for 40 years. And she said, and I think you should write it, Yvette. And I thought about it and I thought, no one has written that book. Okay, that's a really good idea. So I started writing it only in October last year. That's 9 months ago. And it's nearly finished, so you have not been waiting forever.
Okay, all right.
My books normally take me about 2 years to write. So to have gotten this, and it is a massive book, done in nearly nine, well, it's going to be more than 9 months by the time it's finished. But to do it in that short amount of time is nothing short of remarkable, thank you very much.
Yes.
So filling stitches, when you talk about filling stitches and Hardanger, is it something where you could just sit down and list them out and have your list for the book? Or was it, I know these stitches and are there more and you go looking?
Well, there are the stock standard ones, which are the ones that I have tended to use, the more traditional ones. But, there's a gazillion, actually. And so there were many that I'd never tried before and I just had to search them out. And some I looked in old books. I looked in old Norwegian books. I looked across the web to see pictures of what people had stitched. And I looked everywhere that I possibly could. So sometimes I was working with just a picture. Sometimes there were instructions. Sometimes there were instructions, but they were in a different language. So for me, it was learning how to do them all and then cleaning up the process to make it as good and as easy as possible and working out all the tips and tricks to make it look just so. So one of the things that a lot of people say to me that they struggle with is tension, which we've mentioned already today, I feel. And so that's something that I have tried to focus on in the book, helping people correct their tension, helping people to know this is a stitch that tension is really important with so that they know right from the beginning that's something to focus on. So just trying to make it as easy as possible for people to learn a very wide range of stitches.
So this book then has expanded your horizons in terms of what you can do with Hardanger.
Oh, yes. But a lot of the stitches I'm likely never to use again because I tend to focus on the traditional sorts of stitches. So many of these are not at all traditional. Doesn't mean they're not great, but it's probably not something that I will employ in my work very often.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So is this going to be a how to do these stitches book or more of a project
definitely
book?
Definitely is. No, it's all about how to do them. So there's about 100 stitches and their variations in it. And I have step-by-step instructions for each of those stitches in both left-handed and right-handed, because I am left-handed, so, you know, I'm catering that for that part of the market. And that takes up so much space that there really hasn't been room for a whole heap of projects. So there's one project in this book, and it's a sampler, which uses as many of the stitches as I could possibly fit in on that sampler.
Mm-hmm. So it's a big, giant sampler.
Well, it's not that massive, but, you know, you can fit a lot into a small space, really.
It's a bed sheet.
If you worked it on a large enough counter fabric, you could make it into a bed sheet.
I think it's great you're doing the left hand. Of course, you're left-handed, so that just follows. But we were having a conversation last week, was it, about left and right hand, and mm-hmm. it was funny because when it comes up, everybody immediately puts their hands out to figure out which one goes on the bottom and which one goes on the top.
Right.
Yeah, and because we were talking, and because I'm left-handed, and so, mm-hmm. but I don't really think about it. It's never been an issue for me, but I know for some people, especially if they see a right-hander do a stitch. To translate that is really a struggle. And a battle. Because you have one or two books for left-handers already.
Well, I have the Left-Handed Embroiderer's Companion.
Yeah.
But quite a few of my books, all of the later ones, also have left-handed instructions as well as right-handed instructions.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who's a left-handed, and I remember her getting your left-handed book and her being so excited because she really wanted to perfect her craft. And it just was so, it was like, it was mind blowing, eye opening, all those things, because then all of a sudden the stitches made sense to her.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely to hear.
So, yeah, I always recommend it. If I meet someone who's a left-handed and they're looking for a book, I'm like, this is the one you need.
Well, thank
this
you.
Is the one you need.
What's that like when you're stitching? Have you had to become ambidextrous when you're not when you're stitching, but when you're teaching?
Yeah, so I do teach right-handers right-handed as much as I possibly can. Sometimes it doesn't actually matter because the stitches worked the same in the same method for both left and right-handers. It's just you got your needle in a different hand. But yeah, I try to teach right-handed, and I do feel that I am reasonably ambidextrous. It's just that when I am teaching right-handers, I always say to them, just please excuse me if I have to think this through first and then show you, because I'm figuring it out left-handed and then figuring out what you're going to do.
Yeah, bit of a process, yeah. So when you're researching this new book, what is it the kind of thing, I mean, you want to get these filling stitches right according to way, you know, history and the way they were originally done, I assume. Does that mean you have to find two and three sources that all show it the same way? Or I'm just curious about the process you go through to make sure that when you show a stitch, it's authentic and it's not some Americanized lazy version, you know?
Well, it depends on how old the stitch is. A lot of the stitches in this book are quite contemporary. And so, you know, the little old lady down the road may have devised it herself and we're following her instructions because she came up with it. For the older stitches, there aren't that many resources for us to draw on. There are some, but not a huge number. And so generally I would go with as many sets of instructions as I have and bring them all together to make instructions that give you the best result. So it may not be completely historically accurate. I would try to make it that way, but if there's something that I can suggest to make it that little bit easier or a little bit better, then I will do that. I've never said that this is the way to do it. This is my way to do it, and it gives me my best results.
So you're not a purist.
I am.
No, but I mean, in terms of this, make sure that people can stitch it more than forcing them to do it some antiquated way.
Well, we don't necessarily know what the antiquated way is, and there may not be an antiquated way. So therefore, the aim for me is to get the best results.
I just wonder because, so many of your books are all these old techniques and styles that you've brought to life. And I just wonder how far you go with that. And I know you do a lot of research to try and be true to the original way, but so there is some latitude there to make it approachable for people or to get the best result then.
Well, there is, because sometimes all I'm working from is a photograph of an historical piece that I've seen in a museum somewhere, and that doesn't come with instructions. So I have to work that out myself.
So was it hard to do this book then, because you had to do it pretty much online still? I mean,
No, because I've been to museums before to look at Hardanger embroidery. So I've been to the Hardanger Folk Museum in Norway, and I've been to the Norsk Folk Museum in Oslo, and I've looked at so many pieces there and photographed them from the front and the back, because the back's also important sometimes to help you understand how the stitch works, that I didn't need to travel for this book, which was one of the reasons why it's been so pleasurable, because I've just been able to get in there and do it. And so normally when I write a book, I'll go overseas to the place where it comes from and I'll research it. And then I've got to look at all those photographs that I seek permission to take and just let it sort of congeal in my head and make sense before I can start writing the book. Well, I haven't had to this time, because so many of these stitches I've done before that they've made sense, and there hasn't been so much about the style to learn as just specific steps.
Yeah. So glad you mentioned about the back. Cindy Baldwin and I were recording the Wednesday show earlier today, and which doesn't matter because people listen to this many days later, but we were talking about the back and the backs of samplers, but I had commented that I love to look at the back of people's stitching, because I feel like you can learn as much or more from the back than the front. And, you know, so many people just get all worked up about not looking at the back. All that matters is the front. But in terms of education, I just have always believed that I can learn an awful lot from stitchers of many levels about how to go about a stitch.
Yeah, you certainly can. And there are some stitches that look pretty much the same on the front. So you might think that now there's herringbone and something or other else that's really similar from the front. And when you turn it over to the back, you can see that they are two completely different stitches. Now, if I didn't turn over to the back, I wouldn't know that. So if I'm in a class teaching and I look at the back of someone's work, I will usually say to them, I am not wanting to check how neat this is. I'm wanting to check that what is on the back looks the way it should, because that helps me to understand that your method is correct or incorrect. So, yeah, I mean, you can look at the back. I mean, and a lot of people do. They look at the back to see, oh, that's really messy. And you like you see people walk up to a piece of embroidery that is able to be touched, pick it up and look at the back, and you think, why on earth do you do that? And they are just wanting to be judgmental, I think.
Yeah.
But for those of us who want to understand, then that is actually a very important and legitimate thing to do sometimes, to look at the back.
Yeah. Whenever I have a chance to look at the back, and I've had to catch myself several times to stop from flipping it over, because people get really worked up about it. But especially if you've got a talented stitcher, I don't care what the technique is, you can learn, you know, how do they deal from stitch to stitch with their thread? Yeah, there's just so much back there that is helpful.
There is.
Yeah.
And don't you think on some of these white work techniques, because they're so, you know, they're lacy, so you've got to be very careful with the back so that it looks, because if not, it shows on the front. And that's the only reason I pay attention to the back, is if it shows up on the front and it makes a difference on the front.
Yes.
But especially with when you're cutting, like the Hardanger, and you know, if you don't, even wrap those cloister boxes the right way. I mean, I remember when I was learning and I had someone, you know, she flipped my thing over. She goes, Beth, you're going to have to redo this because I cut a corner, you know, went through a corner. And she was like, you know, when you cut, you're going to cut that and it's all going to come apart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better to stop and redo this now than to do it later. So, yeah.
Though if you're going to make that mistake in a class, is the best place to make that mistake because someone can show you how to fix it.
Right, right. That's true. That's true. I just hate fixing those mistakes. Those are I try to avoid those. Yeah.
I think that's a very wise thing.
Well, but that's one of the things I enjoy about your books is you show those kinds of details, and I feel like if I follow them, that I'll come out the other end okay, and not like Beth said, cut and have it all come apart on you.
Well, that is my aim. I'd like you to be successful.
Well, it does work. Yep, it does work.
Excellent.
One of the things I really wanted to talk about is this whole, I mean, you've got a whole series of books, various techniques. And to me, yeah, the books show the techniques and it's beautiful needlework and blah, 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 all of that. But to me, the really important contribution is preserving these techniques, bringing them to the forefront so that, you know, other than some small town in the middle of nowhere, where they're still stitching it, everybody can learn, but the technique is preserved. Mm-hmm. And to me, that your books are, that's the real power and treasure is that you've preserved these things. Was that what you started out to do, or was it just curiosity and I'll do a book and show how to do it?
It certainly wasn't what I set out to do in the beginning. I was offered the chance to write a book on hardanger embroidery, and I took that chance. And then I started looking at more obscure types of embroidery as time has gone on. And now I definitely do see myself as an embroidery historian, because to me, preserving the techniques and the skills is just as important as a museum curator preserving the actual artifacts in their museum.
Yeah. Yeah, these kinds of things always take me back to the list they have in England of the endangered crafts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was Elizabeth Ashdown we talked to not too long ago.
Right.
And talked about how just a handful of years she had checked the list and two or three of them had gone away. Nobody was doing them anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just so, to me, it's just so important that, you know, I don't care what the needlework technique is, the history, all of it has such history to it, and to preserve that and to keep these things at least documented is just so critical to me.
Mm, yeah, and it can be really important for those people's expression of culture. So one of the unexpected things that's happened for me with the Ukrainian war that's happening is that I was contacted by a shop owner in Ukraine who wanted to buy some copies of my Ukrainian book. Now, I have been very careful not to promote my Ukrainian book during this time at all, because I think that's quite repulsive that I should be profiting from other people's misfortune. But she wanted to buy some copies to sell in her shop to the Ukrainian women who are sitting at home waiting for their menfolk to come home and most likely fretting, I'm sure. But while they're doing that, they're using that time to do embroidery as an expression of their Ukrainianness. And for me, that's just been an amazing thing that I can be involved in that by having written that book many years ago. So that's just a really lovely way to see how embroidery can help people through difficult times.
Yeah, yeah, I had forgotten until I listed out the books just to make notes that you had done that book, and immediately what came to my mind is, oh, I'm glad there's a book that documents this, because who knows when it's all over how much damage will have been done. I mean, certainly enough already, but You know, how many historic artifacts are going to be gone, and you know, the fact that you've documented these techniques and show how to do them, will I think to in some degree or another be valuable.
Well, I'm not the only person that has written on that, so there are other people that have also recorded these things as well. Mine's just a contribution towards that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's wonderful, because you don't want to lose. No one wants to lose that.
No,
part of your heritage, not. You know.
Yeah,
you know, and unless it's written down or documented in some way, it's easy to lose. It's.
So you have evolved into an historian from originally just writing a book. Does that mean now that you are seeking out other techniques that you'd like to explore, or?
I don't really need to, because I've got a very, very long list of books to write.
Okay.
Oh, so you already have your list.
Oh, I've been compiling this list over many years, and occasionally I'll get to tick something off it. There's a list that other people have for me as well.
Oh, wow.
Which, yes, some people come to me and say, why don't you write a book on this, Yvette? And I think, oh, well, yeah. And sometimes there's really good reasons why not to, and other times it just doesn't seem to fit with me. But, yeah, I'm sure there are other people who would have some suggestions for me if they wanted to.
It's good to have help, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's how this current book, the Hardanger Filling Stitches book, came about, because someone suggested it to me, and it's just the whole thing has felt like a real gift. The idea was given to me, and it's just because it's been not something that I've had to labor over, and it hasn't been difficult. It's just flowed out of me, and it's been quite a lovely process.
Yeah. Do you look in your list? Are there other parts of the world, techniques from other parts of the world that, you know, for instance, Southeast Asia or South America that you look at, or is it?
I would love to explore those areas through their embroidery, but as my main focus is white work and they don't have strong white work traditions, no, I haven't managed to find myself there yet.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I wondered that if there's white work done elsewhere in the world, so there really isn't then.
It's mostly done in Europe.
Yeah. It's interesting. You'd think somewhere along the way it would have migrated in some form or another.
Well, maybe they just are much too bright and happy in their culture to want to focus solely on white.
Yeah, okay, fine. When you do this kind of research, how much do you rely on museums, internet?
I rely heavily on museums.
Okay.
There is nothing like seeing the real thing. So when I choose a topic for a book, the first thing that I need to know is that there is enough in the historical record for me to actually look at and study. Like, it's not just 10 pieces that I'd be working from, but, you know, tens and hundreds if possible. Because otherwise I don't get a real idea of what the style is just from looking at those few examples. So I will generally contact the museums that I believe hold pieces like this and arrange to go and see them, spend time with the curators. And it's just an amazing time of learning. And I feel very privileged to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's a real collaboration with the people at the museum when you go to explore these?
It can be. It's interesting that some of the curators have an enormous amount of knowledge about what I want to look at, and sometimes they're a textiles curator that focuses more on other areas. So I have worked with textiles curators who they have amazing knowledge of what I'm wanting to look at, and others who knitting might be their actual thing instead. Yeah. And they just have a small amount of knowledge in the area that I want to look at.
So in those instances, it's here's the stuff.
It is.
Study it as much as you want, because that's it.
Yep. And that it's also me saying to them, may I have permission to photograph these pieces, please? And I will also ask for permission to publish those photographs, and that may or may not be granted. So sometimes the photographs that I have are only for my research purposes, and other times I have gained permission to actually publish them as well.
Oh.
So I spend a lot of time looking at those pieces at the museum, photographing them, all the details from the front and the back, but then much of the work happens at home afterwards in me poring over those photographs. And occasionally I'll find something that I have missed. Like there might be a stitch that I'm not quite sure about, and I have to look through and see, do I have a photograph of the back of that? And if I don't, then I'm slightly up the creek. But there have been times when I've gone back to a curator and said, I've realized that I didn't get anything on this. Is there any possibility that you could send me some images? And some of them are very kind.
Yeah, and I'm sure some are just too busy. Yeah.
We're right. Yeah, I never want to presume on their time. Just because I find it important to me doesn't mean it's important to them. Yeah. In the scheme of things.
I remember those days, my photography days, when I would get to a place to photograph and knew I would never get back there again. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you just take a ridiculous amount of pictures just so you don't have that one that you missed. Yeah.
Yeah.
What? Thank goodness for digital cameras.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
What is it that about museums that they would not let you publish the photos, or they just don't want public knowledge of what they have?
They may let me publish them if I pay them a fee, or they may prefer that the images that are released are by their professional photographers only.
Oh.
And that's fair enough. They want to put their best foot forward, and sometimes they feel that that's the best way they can do that.
Hmm. Okay.
And if that's the case, then I would have to negotiate to use their photographs.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So when you're doing this, is it a tripod and digital SLR or phone or what?
No, it's tripod and digital SLR, yeah. And I have a very tiny, tiny, very light tripod because I'd like to travel very light when I'm overseas.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine, especially with white work, that you don't want any image blur at all.
No.
Yeah. Real challenge there. Yep. Set up. Now, when they get these pieces out, are you normally allowed to handle them?
With gloves. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, it would be very difficult if I had to ask them to turn over to the back all the time. But no, they're usually quite, they treat me as a professional, which is what I am, and they allow me to look at the pieces in the way that I need to, and they'll often just go off and do their own work rather than, you know, hovering over me, which would be a very boring thing for them to do all day.
It'd drive me nuts. Nice.
And it's nice though that they have confidence in you too.
It is very nice. Yes. Yes. That is very gratifying.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, so that's usually in the back room on a big mm-hmm. table and,
yes. Boy,
that's gotta be, yep. What a privilege to be able to go into those areas in a museum.
It is. And there was one museum that I went to that my husband was with me, and they could see that I was going to be there for a time. So they let him loose in the back room so that he could just explore.
Oh. Wow.
Oh.
He wins.
Nice.
Yeah.
He wins.
So
yeah.
He got to see a whole lot more than I did, but I got to see things that I wanted to see. So that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. When it comes, you know, I'm just curious about museums in general for this kind of work. Is your best resource in larger cities, or are there small museums in towns that become the little gold mines?
I would tend to say it's the little gold mines, yes. 'Cause the large museums in the cities often want to have a collection that represents perhaps the whole country and maybe other countries' work as well. But it's the little ones in the middle of nowhere that have their pieces that are important to that region, that, yeah, they are gold mines.
Yeah, I'm sure those people are glad to have someone who truly is interested in what they have to offer, too.
They are, and often they're quite surprised that I've come all the way from Australia to look at our stuff. Yes.
Yeah, it's not like you jumped in a car and drove for a couple hours, that's for sure.
No.
It's a commitment.
I value your culture and your history that highly that I wanted to come all this way to see it.
Yep. Have you do you also try to connect with people who are practicing techniques in particularly in these small towns, or is that really difficult to pull off because of language?
I do, but sometimes these embroideries are not currently done anymore. So those people don't exist anymore. Where they do, yes, I try to meet up with them. But if they don't, then, yeah, it's just me and the embroidery.
Yeah, that's got to be fun, though, to sit down with people who are practicing old techniques. And I'm sure there's, through the needle and thread, there's a universal language.
Yeah, there is. And just to see skilled needle people at work is an amazing thing.
Yeah. The what's the most obscure place you've been, or most out of the way place you've been? And
oh, it's a bit hard to say because I wouldn't want anyone to think that their town was the one that I deem the most obscure.
Well, that wasn't the right word, but
I've been to tiny little museum, well, it's probably not that tiny, in a town called Skien, which is S-K-I-E-N in Norway, where I looked at the collars for the Smoig book that I wrote. Where else have I been? I'd say that was probably the most out of the way one. Oh, the Hardanger Folk Museum in Utna is, you know, this little museum with an amazing collection sitting on the side of a fjord. But yeah, amazing things to look at. So it really doesn't matter where it is, as long as they've got a good collection policy.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Well, how do you find those museums? That's the thing. I know, my husband and I were in a little town and we just happened to be walking around and they had this little town museum and we walked in. It was, I think it was the earthquake, the Maridoja earthquake that happened. Anyway, and so I went walking around, and then all the way upstairs in the little corner was a crazy quilt and some samplers, mm-hmm. which was interesting. But, I mean, we just happened to wander in because it was raining. How do you find these museums?
There's a bit of sleuthing involved sometimes. And that can be contacting, say, the main museum, the main ethnographic museum in a country, and saying, do you hold pieces of this style of embroidery? And if you don't, can you suggest where I would be able to see them? Sometimes it might be finding a non-English language book on the topic and looking at where they got their images from. And sometimes I'm sure I miss out on opportunities. And when many years ago when we were travelling through Scotland, we stopped one day to have lunch by the side of the road and we were at the end of a driveway. And many years later, we discovered that we had lunch opposite the driveway for Blair Castle, where there is the most amazing collection of work by Mary, Queen of Scots. And we didn't go and see it. We had lunch there.
Oh, painful.
Yes. So, yeah, I'm sure there are places that have works that I would love to see that I just don't know about. I have also on one occasion been taken to the collection of a private collector who that was arranged by a friend for me to go to her collection, and that was an amazing opportunity. So sometimes it's just asking the right questions of the right people.
Yeah. As time has gone by, has the internet become a more valuable tool, or is it still fairly limited?
I couldn't do what I do without the internet.
Okay.
I can say that hands down. No question. The museums in Norway have, I'm assuming they have invested an awful lot of money in digitizing a lot of their collections, and that's all available online. So, you know, I've focused on Norwegian embroidery quite a lot over the years, and that has been an amazing tool for me. But even just to contact people without the internet, it would be so much harder because, you know, we can always send an email in, well, I can write it out in English and then I can use a translation tool to translate it into the language, and I can send both the English language version and the, let's say, German version as well, and send that off to a person. Whereas if I called them, I only speak English, and that would be a very difficult conversation to have. So, yeah, without the internet, I couldn't do what I do.
Yeah. So these museums have, over the years then, more and more of them have digitized their collections, so it really becomes an excellent resource.
Yeah, and I would say mostly that would be the larger ones. But, you know, if there's money going around and people have been able to do it, then that is a fantastic thing.
Yeah. What a detective job. Yeah.
But that's fun. I also do rely on my husband a bit. He's a librarian. So, you know, research is his thing. So sometimes I'll say, I need to know about this. And he'll go off and find whatever he can for me.
Yeah, they have skills, don't they?
They do.
Yeah. Yep, they do. Yep. Yeah. So then this the new book now, Filling Techniques, that's going to be early next year for the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. It's looking that way. So I am currently trying so very hard to get it finished, and my plan is to hopefully have it off to the printer within the next 2 months. It generally takes about 2.5 months to 3 months to come back to me. So we could be looking at an Australian and New Zealand release before the end of the year, but things take a little bit further to, there's longer to go further. So, yeah, I think the rest of the world will probably be early 2024.
Yeah. A number of people that go through all your illustrations and stitch them and give you feedback, or are you pretty confident yourself?
No, what I do generally is I write the instructions and then I leave them for either weeks or months and come back and I stitch from them. And that's when I pick up a lot of mistakes or just things that haven't been quite clear. But I do also give the whole book to my husband, who doesn't know very much about embroidery at all. And if he can understand it, then I figure anyone can.
Yeah. Hey, that works.
Yep.
Yeah, my first magazine editing job, we had a managing editor, and it was Research and Development was the title of the magazine. It was all high-end scientific research, and she was our test. She would go through all the manuscripts, and she knew nothing.
And
she'd come back and say, hey, I don't know what you're talking about, but this doesn't seem to fly. And
that
kind of thing. And she was right just about every time. It's like, oh, yeah, you're right. This is not clear. And, I know that experience. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of insight is just invaluable.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Sandy Brown, she'd come back, I tell you, I don't think this is making sense to me. And then you immediately get defensive. Well, yeah, but it doesn't mean this. It doesn't. You're not saying it right. Yep. Yep. Sandy Brown, she was our check. Yep. Not a lick of science behind her, but she could read and edit, and that was good. Yeah. Yeah, it's good that you have that. So then the artwork, I mean, it's a lot of artwork in your books. Who does all that? Is that the publisher?
No, that's me.
Oh, that's you too.
So me writing a book is me actually drawing the diagrams, photographing, writing the text, putting it on the page. It is a one-man band here, one-woman band. But that's why my books turn out the way they do, because I actually design for the page. So I know that I can fit, depending on how big the pictures need to be, maybe 15 steps on the page. So I will write to fit that. because there's nothing worse than going over to the next page with one diagram.
Right.
So, yeah, that's how I make such good use of the space. If it was me working with a designer, working with an illustrator, I think my books would end up very differently. But because I do it all, I can make it work.
Mm. Man, that's a lot of work. Holy smokes.
It is. And let's just remind everyone, I started in October last year, so do not complain about the fact you're still waiting for this book.
We just need to be patient.
Exactly. I have been saying to people, it takes as long as it takes. And if I'm to rush it, then you won't get the good book that you're hoping for. Yeah. If you let me take the time it takes, you will get the right book.
And in the meantime, you're designing and teaching.
I'm not doing much teaching at the moment because I've just been so flat out with this book. but yes, it is always my intention to teach as well.
Yeah. Now, have you developed a pretty good white work following, if you will, in Australia that you can keep busy teaching, or do you have to travel?
I do a lot of teaching in Australia, usually to small groups, and they might be country guild groups that find it hard to get teachers, and I'm always happy to come to them because I love going out to them. but I do love international travel as well. So where possible, I submit for international conferences, and I don't always get selected, and that's just the way things are. And it's particularly difficult to get into the US with the whole visa situation.
Oh, yes. I didn't know that was a problem.
It is. So if the US says that they've got people who can already teach that, then they're not going to grant a visa to someone coming from overseas because they don't want the work taken away from one of their own. And that's fair enough. But yeah, it does make it difficult for us.
Okay.
Yeah, that's yeah. That I heard that.
I'm quite that was happy hilarious. For the U.S. to want to protect their borders, but I'm not going to come do anything wrong.
Right.
Oh, for crying out loud! This is just.
Yeah. I don't want to start an international incident here. Let's just drop that.
Oh yeah. Oh man, I tell you, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah. So
it is a privilege when I am able to come to teach in America. Let's say that.
Okay, yeah, Matt.
And I was just thinking when before we started recording that I would, if you came close enough that I could take a class, I would take whatever you offered, beginner, intermediate, just because I think I would learn so much from sitting and being in a class with you. I think,
Well, that's what I hope most people feel.
but I think sometimes people think, well, I have the book. I can learn from the book. And you can. Your books are wonderful. You can learn from the book. But there's something about an in-person class where you learn so much more, I think.
I do agree with that. Yeah. And I do try to make my books as complete as possible. So it is as if I'm sitting next to you teaching you. But there is something different about being with the people and doing it in front of them. And a big part of that for me is also going around the class and checking people's work, because a lot of the work that I teach is so precise. And if you're not in the right spot, it's not going to work out properly. So that is something that I bring to a class, that I can do that. I can walk around and say, I think that one might be out of place. Let's just check that. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'm just unsure about, how an online class could work in that way. I have been getting a lot of requests for teaching online classes to American guild groups, and I think it's a fabulous idea because, you know, it means that they can have access to me without having to go through the whole rigmarole of getting me there and the cost of getting me there, but I'm just still not sure how I can make that work in a way that the students would be entirely satisfied with.
Right. Because you have the issue of internet dropping, which, yep. you know, you have good cameras. Can people see? Can students actually show you what they're working on?
Yeah, I can show them what I'm working on because I've got a really good camera setup for that. But if you're working with your iPhone and you are not really sure about focusing, then it's very difficult for me to count accurately on a blurry photograph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
I'd love to be able to make it work, but I just haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that there's many requests for you to do an online class. I'm still struggling with the visa thing, but I guess I'll just move on. Come on. That. Okay. Well, there we have it. Now I see I've learned something that just irritates me, but oh well. Jeez. I was wondering, I thought that we would wrap up here. Just some tips. I was having a conversation with someone a week or two ago, and we were talking about Hardanger and that 22 count cloth that is always marketed as Hardanger cloth, as opposed to doing it on linen. And we were just talking about the pros and cons of that and how it has some benefits in that if you've not done it before, you know, it kind of confines you so that you can learn. But when you teach, do you just use linen, or how do you approach that?
I use linen.
Okay.
And the main reason why I use linen is that Hardanger fabric, which some people know as Aida, which is not the same as what people use for cross stitch. But look, I've got real issues with fabric companies and their stupid naming of fabrics. The whole idea that they've called this cotton fabric even weave, which makes people think that that's the only fabric that's even weave, but even weave just means that we've got the same number of threads over the same distance for both the warp and the weft. That could be linen, it could be cotton, it could be viscose. So I'll just get down off my soapbox now. So I use linen because that is traditionally what they used. They did not use this double weave fabric that's cotton, which is known to many people as Hardanger fabric. My assumption is that some executive in a company somewhere decided, we need to move more of this fabric, so we're going to call it Hardanger fabric and market it specifically for Hardanger. And that might mean we get rid of some of this stock. And quite frankly, I wish they hadn't, because they don't use that fabric in Norway traditionally at all. And it's been a real problem for people to try and get past that idea.
Yeah, because it's the official cloth of the technique, yes.
Yes, but it's not.
So linen is your that's because that's the way it was done. Any particular count that you thread count?
If I'm trying to teach it traditionally, so with the traditional linen threads and the traditional fabric, then I will often go for something like a 36 count, because that is about the lowest count that they would have used. If I'm wanting to be really nice to my students, then I'll move to a 28 or a 25 count, just so, because, you know, eyes often appreciate that a lot more.
Yeah.
And so I try to keep my students in mind where I can.
Yeah.
And occasionally I'll have had a student come to me before a class and say, look, I really would like to do the class and I can't do it in the count that you are providing. Would it be okay if I scaled up to a larger count? And there are some times when that's not going to work, depending on the technique, but for Hardanger it does. And so, yeah, I have had that happen on occasions, and that's okay. It means that they can access the class.
Yeah, yeah. But right. Typically the mid-30s is where you like to be.
Yes, yes. I have done some Hardanger, or have I done Hardanger? I've done Friesian and white work on 50 count. I don't think my eyes are good enough for that anymore.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, I saw that in the book. It's the little pendant
Yeah, yeah.
Which is gorgeous.
I'll have people come and want to buy that from me at the craft show that I often do. And I will always say to them, now, do you realize that this is on 50 count? And some of them say, oh, what's that? And I'll show them, oh, I don't think I could do that. And some people say, oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. So, you know, different eyes can cope with different things.
Yeah.
Right. I do think there's an interesting thing that's happening, I think, in the world of samplers where people are wanting to, I think, impress others by the smallest count that they can possibly use. And there seems to be this rivalry with people trying to go smaller and smaller and smaller. Look, I'm all for that because, you know, that's great for people actually moving to higher counts, which I like to teach on higher counts. And if that's the way they get there, then that's great. But, yeah, I do think there's some sort of you need to be impressed by me because I can do this.
Right, right. And I think sometimes some of the techniques, like if you're doing something more, a little more surface on it, like a queen stitch, you get too small of a count, you can't really see those
stitches. Yeah, it loses the effect somewhat,
right.
Doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Yeah. Wow. There's gotta be a perfect spot. I did not know this was happening.
Oh, yeah. Jeez. Just been sitting back and watching and thinking, well, go for it, ladies.
One upsmanship on thread count. Yeah, okay.
It is.
Well, and I have a question then. So if, what about the over dye, the things that are, you don't traditionally use those, but would you recommend people not use them? I was wondering if the dyeing process changes the evenness of the count. So will it still be like if you had something that's overdyed at 36 count, will it still be 36 count all the way around? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like I know what you're saying. Sometimes yes and sometimes no. So there was a colored fabric that I used from a particular manufacturer some years ago, which was supposed to be a particular count, and it was supposed to be even weave. Mm-hmm. And I maintained that it was not because the squares that I worked on it did not turn out square. I took this up with the person that I bought it from and they just said, just deal with it a bit. So normally it is okay. And I, for some of my projects, I might tea dye the fabric and it's still certainly workable on. And I have never, apart from that one instance, found that it changes it so much that it's a problem.
Okay. I was just wondering about that because I thought, because you wouldn't want something to look like a rectangle if it was supposed to be a square. I thought.
No, you wouldn't, but it doesn't mean that it's a problem if it does. So some pieces that I've seen in museums are not necessarily worked on completely even weave fabric. And they still have charm, right. But it's just a different look than what you might be expecting. I have also stitched Sardinian knotted embroidery on dress linen rather than even weave linen. So when you're using dress linen, the weave is usually much more compressed in one dimension than the other. And so it means that things turn out either very squashed or very elongated. And it certainly was doable. But what I kept finding was that I would expect the next stitch to be in a certain place. But because of the compression of those threads, it wasn't there. And so it made it really easy to put your stitches in the wrong place. So my suggestion is that if you are starting off with an embroidery, use something that's even weave if you're meant to be using even weave, because otherwise you're just making life so much harder for yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
And you use linen thread then?
I do use a lot of linen thread because that is what is traditionally used for a lot of old embroideries. For this book, Hardanger Filling Stitches, I've worked the sampler in linen thread, but people will also be able to work it with pearl cotton if they want to. And all of the stitch samples that I'm photographing for each of the stitches, I've stitched in pearl cotton. And that's actually been lovely to go back to pearl cotton and enjoy the shine that it gives.
Yeah. Yeah, it has that benefit. Pearl cotton sometimes irritates me because of the untwisting and twisting issues, but that's just me. Yeah. Now, I've never stitched a piece with linen thread, and I'm asking this question because I was thinking the other day about trying a little project and doing it, you know, with linen and linen thread, and just to experience it. And
You'll find it quite different. When I think linen comes into its own is when you're using pulled thread stitches. Because one of the things that we want to do when we do a pulled thread stitch is maintain tension. Now, linen, one of its natural properties is that it loves to crease. So if you pull that stitch tight and then pinch it so that it stays, you're making use of that property to your advantage. Whereas other cotton threads might just slip back that little bit, the linen is so much less likely to.
Okay, I think I need to try it just for the experience.
One thing that annoys some people about linen thread is so a lot of people when they hear us talking about linen thread, they think of that old horrible stuff many years ago that looked basically like straw. Well, linen threads that we use these days don't look like that. They are beautiful threads with a fine twist with some element of polish to them, and they're quite lovely. But they do have slubs occasionally. So that's just something that you've got to be aware of, that you may get a slub turn up. Sometimes you can pick them out and retwist that section. In doing that, you are going to be slightly weakening the thread. But if that means that you can use that section of thread, whereas otherwise you would have had to cut it out, then I think it's always worth giving a go. And then you'll know as soon as you cut it off the reel or the ball or whatever that it's got that slub in it. So you'll know at that point whether it's worth trying to pick it out or not. But it can be done. But it's just after you've picked it out, then retwist that section or it will just disintegrate there.
After you put the stitches in, of course.
Maybe. Or as you're doing.
At the most irritating time, I'm sure.
Yeah, you're right. So then you have to unpick everything and start that area again. Ask me how I know that.
How do you know that, Beth?
So I was supposed to twist it up again, huh, after I picked the slub out, huh? Yeah, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no, that helps.
There you go. Your tip for the day, Beth.
Yes, and I needed to know that because I've had that issue.
Come and do a class with me. You'll learn these things.
I'd love to come take a class with you. Oh, I don't know what my husband would say. I need to fly to Australia.
He'll say, oh, can I come too?
Probably.
That'd be okay. I mean, there's quite, across Australia, quite a stitching community. You know, that's one thing that I feel that I've learned doing all these podcasts is that there are just so many needleworkers in Australia and of all kinds. And it's fun to talk to them because, I'm not going to say that you wouldn't expect that in Australia, but there just is a real large active community there that I think is impressive. And it's really some unique work that comes out of those people. And
I would say the same for New Zealand as well, actually.
Yeah.
When I've taught in New Zealand, I'm always incredibly impressed with their skill. There's some very highly skilled needlewomen there.
Mm.
Probably needlemen too, but they haven't been in my classes, so I can't assess them.
Yeah, there are one or two of us, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are.
A few of you.
Happens. Mm-hmm. All right, Yvette, we got to stop. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
Always fun. Always fun. So needlework filling stitches coming to us early next year.
It's called hardanger filling stitches.
Hardanger. Sorry. I was looking at the word needlework here in my notes and hardanger. Now we can pre-order that, right?
You certainly can. Yes. Go to your favorite needlework shop and ask them if they can get it for you.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we know one, so we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right. Thanks, Yvette. Thanks to everyone for listening.